Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
A lot of times when I have these conversations with patients, I try to understand how it's impacting their overall functioning, especially in those patients that are older. Are they limiting certain activities that are allowing them to be independent?
Today, Drs. Dadania and Modi join the podcast to discuss floaters, imaging tools, decision-making, including surgery and patient counseling, in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative supporters.
Hello, I'm Vaidehi Dadania, the Program Director for the Retina Fellowship and Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at NYU Langone Health in New York City.
And I'm Yasha Modi, Associate Professor of Ophthalmology, Specialist in Retina and Uveitis at NYU as well.
Today we will be discussing vitreous opacities or floaters, when and how we image and evaluate them, when and whether to pursue surgery, including conditional circumstances that may influence our decision-making, as well as counseling our patients. Ready to get started?
Sounds great, Vaidehi.
So Yasha, can you give me a little bit of what you tend to do for your patients when they come in with floaters?
You know, I think the most important thing is really trying to assess how impactful this is in their lives. One, age. Is there a PVD, which I guess we can talk a little bit about? And how symptomatic are they? Is this more of a nuisance, or is this going to be something where it's affecting their ability to drive to work? And if it's the latter, where it's starting to really impact their ability to function, then all of a sudden we're starting to think a little bit about therapeutics.
That's a great point. A lot of times when I have these conversations with patients, I try to understand how it's impacting their overall functioning, especially in those patients that are older. Are they limiting certain activities that are allowing them to be independent? So can you tell me, how does this play into your surgical decision making? And when do you decide to pursue vitrectomy or other procedures for these patients, if there are others that you pursue?
Well, I think let's take a step back and let's just talk a little bit about the perception of floaters and what that actually corresponds to. You know, we have vitreous sinuresis, condensation, and liquefaction as we get older. And all of those can really diffract light, creating the perception of floaters. And that's where you sort of see those like little amoeba shadows, if you will, when you're kind of looking up at a blue sky. But then as we get older, we eventually progress to a PVD, and now the entirety of the poster hyaloid can be creating a shadow. And add that into somebody who, for instance, has like maybe a diffractive multifocal intraocular lens, and you can imagine there's now a number of like modalities that can result in scattering of light.
So you touched upon a really important point here. Do you think a PVD is necessary for these patients to A, exhibit these symptoms, and B, to go ahead with surgery or recommend surgery?
Yeah, that's, I mean, a really, really great question. So overwhelmingly, I do not recommend the surgery if they do not have a PVD. And you could sort of say, well, why is that? And the rationale is because if they already have a PVD, one major risk has already been mitigated for you, which is the risk of retinal tear as we are lifting the posterior hyaloid. And so in that circumstance, I love that because their risk of retinal tear is probably less than 1%, as opposed to if I'm lifting the posterior hyaloid, that can be as high as somewhere around 5 to 10%. So Vaidehi, for you, first of all, when you're doing the surgery, what happens? One, do they need a PVD? And two, what happens if you go into the operating room and you find out there isn't a PVD?
So to answer your first question, I tend not to go in and do surgery or recommend surgery in patients that do not have a PVD, or that on preoperative exam, I don't see a PVD. Now, sometimes in these patients, it can be difficult. I do utilize my OCT to help identify whether or not they have a PVD, because they do have a large extent of these vitreous floaters and condensation. But I tend to only operate on patients with a PVD. Now, let's say I do go in and I see a patient does not have a PVD. I will spend my time there inducing a PVD. I counsel these patients beforehand that if they don't have a PVD, when a PVD develops, if I leave the hyaloid down, they may be more likely to continue to experience floaters at another point in time or develop a retinal tear or detachment when the hyaloid is still attached. That said, you bring me to a great point. What do you do in patients that, for example, have astroid hyalosis that you're operating on and they don't have a PVD?
Yeah, I think you bring up probably sort of the nightmare for retina surgeons sometimes, which is the case of astroid, which are, you know, these sort of can be highly refractile and oftentimes asymptomatic, but as they get hyoid separation, that's when they really start to become very much symptomatic. And the interesting thing about asteroid hyalosis, and this is true, pretty much any retina surgeon knows this, is that there's a very strong adhesion of the vitreoretinal interface. So in these cases, I think we have to be very careful about how we address them. You know, for those where I always try to induce a PVD, I completely agree with you that I think I'd like to take on that risk at this moment in time rather than have a problem later down the road when they do develop a PVD. So here I try to elevate the posterior hyoid. If I'm successful, I think that's great. On the other hand, if it's taken me sort of 10, 15 minutes and I'm not succeeding in elevating it, this is the rare circumstance where I will leave the posterior hyoid down because the risk of iatrogenic tear is quite high.
And before you do these cases, Yasha, do you render these patients pseudophagic?
Well, remember, most of these patients, in order to fulfill the definition of a PVD, we're either talking about very young myopes in their mid to late 40s, or we're talking about patients 50 and older. And we know that when we do a vitrectomy, the rate of cataract formation approximates 100%. Now that really depends, you know, it's just a decay function of time. So if we know that they're going to develop a cataract, my number one priority is to have them have cataract surgery first, and then I can then do a very comprehensive removal of the vitreous as well as opening up the posterior capsule at that time.
That's a great point. And I tend to bring that up to patients when we discuss surgery, that this is going to be two surgeries for that eye if they haven't already had cataract surgery. And they're sometimes wondering, you know, well, my cataract is not very bad. Why are you recommending I take it out? And to the points that you made, it's so that I can get the vitreous out as much as possible from behind that lens once they've had it removed, and also so that they can continue to see well afterwards because they're going to develop that cataract either way.
Yeah, and absolutely. And one point is that we've all had the patient post-vit who then goes on to have a YAG capsulotomy, and then they're particularly bothered by the posterior leaflet of the capsule. And so this is really where I like to remove the posterior capsule at the time of the photorectomy surgery.
That's a great point, Yasha. Also, when you're talking to these patients preoperatively about planning, how do you discuss the risk-benefit and the trade-offs?
Well, you bring up a great point. So first of all, we never sign up surgery on the day that I first meet them. I think this is something where patients really have to internalize why they're having surgery. And at that window of time, only afterwards, if they've thought about it for a while, they're completely committed to the idea of surgery, do we then go forward with surgery. And as I told you, they have to be pseudophagic, they have to have a PVD, and this is something where I really cannot stress enough that there are small but serious risks. Risk of endophthalmitis, 1 in 2,000. Risk of retinal tears, about 1%. And if they're willing to undergo that surgical risk, I'm certainly willing to do the surgery.
Those are really excellent points. I think that a lot of this conversation is different from other patients that we operate on. It's that preoperative counseling and that preoperative thought. You know, when we talk about risk benefit, we're thinking about, well, how is this benefiting someone who may not be as debilitated from their symptoms, and how does that balance off with the risk? And so if someone is not able to drive to work, or if they're giving up some of their hobbies because these floaters are disrupting them, then those patients will benefit more than someone who notices those floaters come and go. This has been a great discussion, Yasha. Thanks for joining me today for this discussion about clinical evaluation and decision-making in patients who have vitreous opacities or floaters.
My pleasure, Vedi. This has been great.
And thank you for joining us today.
And that's today's special spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review in your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, or TuneIn. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my flash briefing?" Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Dadania and Modi. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.